Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point. There's no baby on board. The fertility rate in the United States has fallen to a record low. The decline began with the 2008 recession. Although the economy has begun to rebound, the birth rate is not. And experts say why is something of a mystery. This hour on Point, America's empty cradles. You can join us on air or online. Are you having kids? Are you thinking about it? Are your friends? Why or why not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Janet Adamy. She's a news editor at the Wall Street Journal. She covers demographics. You can find a link to her article about the historically low U.S. birth rate at our website, onpointradio.org. Janet Adamy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
Well, this big headline, slowest pace of any generation in U.S. history, are we below replacement rate?
I don't think we're below replacement rate yet, Ray, but the numbers are pretty striking. I mean, we did a chart going back 100 years, and today the 2017 birth rate, 60 babies per 1,000 women per year, that's about half what it was in the 1960s. So it's a pretty dramatic drop.
For all that, in 2017, we did add 3,850,000 babies. We added a Los Angeles. It seems okay, but how much lower is that number than we might have predicted, given the normal rate of birth in the United States?
Well, as you pointed out, this really all started with the 2008 recession. There was essentially a fertility crash after that, because what we know from the research is when the economy gets bad, people put off having babies. But since then, the demographers I've spoken to estimate that there are 4.8 million fewer babies that have been born as a result of this depressed fertility rate. And that's pretty striking.
Well, 4.8 million babies in that decade of, let's say, 08 to 18 means that, go with me here, 2030, 2034, 2036, those are people who don't exist and are not having babies of their own. This is a long tail phenomenon, isn't it?
It is. And where we see a particularly notable effect is when we look at the balance of the population. Demographers like to see a nice balance of younger people and older people in the U.S. population. The baby boomers, many of them have already entered retirement. You have a big group that will be moving in over the next 10, 15 years or so. And so this imbalance creates a lot of pressure on programs like Social Security and Medicare. You don't have the young workers paying into that program. Those programs they face a lot of pressure.
Gallup went out and asked young Americans in 2013, people in their conventional childbearing years, about having children. Only 6% said they didn't have kids and they didn't want them. So that means there is a ready and willing population out there. What do we know about them that's perhaps having them postponing fertility?
So I think the thing that seems most apparent is that even though the economy is quite a bit better than it was 10 years ago, you have these lasting economic scars. So for a lot of these people, it's millennials who've put off having children. They are still, in many cases, digging themselves out of student loan debt. It's become harder to buy a house. They look at the cost of childcare, which is increasing beyond the rate of inflation. And they may have a good job and a good income now, but they haven't quite dug themselves out of that hole that they found themselves in after the recession. We also know that when people wait to have babies, you know, things happen. Women's fertility may not pan out like they had hoped, or life may just take a different turn. So while many of the population may say that they want to have babies, if you wait too long, it can often happen that it just doesn't happen.
I used to cover global public health as a beat. And one of the truisms that people in that game passed back and forth to each other was that it was a good thing for women to be able to space their children and time their children to better times in their family. But does that spacing, timing, and in the American case, delaying, inevitably mean fewer children at the end of it?
I think it can. The demographers I've spoken to say it's not so much that women are, you know, that the person is they were going to have three children and they only had two. It's that they never have the first baby. Another factor that's pretty significant here is you have women in historically high numbers going to college. And what we know from the research is that when women go to college at higher rates, it becomes a bigger trade-off to interrupt a career, even if it's just for a maternity leave. So I think you have some long-term forces here that are really going to put pressure on this trend for a while.
When you look at this in biological terms rather than societal terms, women are able to bear children from an age where we wouldn't really want them to in social terms, but they're perfectly biologically able. And at the other end, some interesting things are happening. The only cohort of American women who had a rise in their birth rate during this last decade is women over 40. What does that tell you?
Well, that's right. So in 2017, it was only women over 40. Interestingly, women in their 30s had been having pretty steady increases. We'd seen a sort of shift in the population away from women in their 20s having children, more women in their 30s. But even in 2017, women in their 30s saw their fertility rates decline. I mean, you have this, you know, modern medicine allows women to have children later in life. And so you're that is one group where you're seeing a big rise. On the other end, there has been just this remarkable drop in teenage pregnancy going back even to the mid-90s. Since 2007, the teen birth rate has declined 55%. And that's generally seen as a good thing because many of those pregnancies are unplanned. Programs like long-lasting contraceptives, IUD, have helped drive that birth rate down.
Well, that's the good news part of the story. I think, from what we know about teen mothers as a group, and what we know about the life chances of their children, I think it's fair to say that a lower teen birth rate is overall a pretty good thing. If you can have that baby at 27 instead of 17, the kid and you are probably better off, right?
Yes, that's what the research shows, that waiting to have kids, those children have better outcomes, they have better health outcomes, they have better educational outcomes. So that is one bright spot. But what I've seen in the research that I've looked at suggests that the lower teen birth rate only accounts for about one-third of this drop in overall fertility. You know, the rest is coming from women in their 20s and 30s. Simply not having kids.
In an interview last week with CBS News, a new mother in Chicago said she ended up having children later in life than she'd originally planned.
Growing up, how old did you think you would be when you had your first child?
Oh, my goodness. In my mind, I was going to be college graduated, married, and with child by, what, 22, 23?
And it didn't happen. She was somewhat older. Let's go to St. Petersburg, Florida. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Hi, I am calling because I'm a millennial. I'm 30 years old. I've chosen not to have children, first of all, because it's not affordable in any way based on my current income and situation. And it's also a huge environmental impact to have children. So it's kind of a moral issue as well.
Do you feel that there's more social sanction, that's an accepted and understood reasoning for you, more than it might have been at another time? Are you freer to be childless by choice than you might have been during your mother's time?
Compared to my mother's time, absolutely. I mean, there's still people who don't think that that's a viable reasoning. Maybe they don't understand the issues or they come from a different background, but it's much more acceptable. There's still a lot of pushback on it, though, for sure.
What form does that pushback take? When you mention it in conversation, if people ask why you don't have any children, what do you tell them?
I tell them I can't imagine supporting it on my income. The prospects going forward for job opportunities are less in my field, and I'm not I don't feel secure enough to bring someone into the world when I'm not even sure if I can pay rent in another year. And people say, well, you know, you'll figure it out. And I think that's just kind of an irresponsible way of looking at it. But a lot of people have done it. So I guess I understand where they're coming from, and maybe I'm looking for them to understand where a lot of people in my situation are coming from, too.
Janet Adamy, is that a familiar tale?
It is. I got many emails after I wrote the story saying, you know, I have a good job, I'm married, but for all the reasons that we talked about before, student loans, trying to save for a down payment, high childcare costs, I'm just hitting an arc in my career that I don't feel like I can do this right now.
I mean, we heard a broad range of explanations from Jessica in Florida, even environmental impact. That kid using up the disposable diapers and water and plastics and so on is going to have a pretty heavy footprint on the rest of the 21st century.
It's an interesting argument because for decades, what we heard was that there was a population explosion coming, that the planet's resources could not handle it. And I think gradually that argument has receded into the background because the argument has shifted toward, well, really, we need the existing population to live in a more environmentally friendly way in order to adequately reduce our strain on the planet. It's not something that you hear as much these days.
And those places in the world that we stereotypically thought of as, well, baby factories, their fertility is cratered too, hasn't it?
We're seeing different things across the planet. I'm across the globe. I think you're seeing maybe some slight declines there. I mean, what you hear most about is places like Europe and Japan, which have even lower birth rates than the U.S.
Janet Adamy is a news editor at The Wall Street Journal. She covers demographics. You can find a link to her article about the historically low U.S. birth rate at our website, onpointradio.org. Janet, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Ray.
We're discussing the historically low birth rate in the United States. You can join the conversation. Have you delayed having a baby? Decided not to have kids at all? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about the factors behind the historically low birth rate in the United States and what it could mean for the future. You can join the conversation. Do you think it'll affect the economy, the labor market, your life, your family? Should we be taking account of this trend in our immigration debates? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Olympia, Washington, is Stephanie Kuntz. She's a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College and the author of many books on the subject, including The Way We Really Are, Coming to Terms with America's Changing Families. Stephanie, welcome to On Point.
Thanks very much, Ray.
When I look back to the last measured time, the women born in 1909 ran right smack into the Great Depression of the 1930s during their childbearing years, and a full 22% of them never had children in their lives.
Yes.
Did that end up having a demographic effect that stretched out on into the decades after that, to the 40s, to the 50s, and so on?
Well, of course, it had some effect on the age makeup of society. But as you know, after World War II, there was this massive increase in the birth rate. In the 1960s, you had a quite exceptional time, I think, for the modern world. You had a situation where women had almost no access to lives outside the home and outside motherhood, very little possibility of combining work with motherhood, or choosing to build a life that was centered around work or involvement in the public sphere. And you had a much larger proportion of young men who could support a family on one wage. And the result was, you know, this big increase in fertility. I don't think that we'll see that again. But it's very interesting that there have been ups and downs in fertility since, and I think we have to rethink what we think of as the best ways to allow people to have children. For me, the most important and concerning thing about this is not the number of people who are voluntarily childless, but the tremendous gap. Actually, just early this year, the gap between what the number of children women said they wanted to have, which was just almost three, and the number that they will probably have reached its highest level in 40 years. And so I think we need to think very seriously about what it is that pushes people into this kind of delaying that your last guest was talking about. And I think that's changing. For example, the fact that education has led to lower fertility rates in the United States is actually being reversed in many Western European and Nordic countries. So we don't have to take this lying down, so to speak.
From our comments line, one person writes, "We had one more child, but could in no way support any more children than two. We have no savings and live paycheck to paycheck. The crash in 08 ensured that we would be behind for the rest of our lives." Another commenter writes, "All I know is that my husband and I got married in 2005. We waited 2 years to have our first baby, and then the economy crashed. He couldn't find construction work for over a year. I'm crushed by student loan debt. We were lucky enough to have purchased our home in 08. That shadow of 08, is that part of the explanation for why birth rates are still depressed almost a decade after the crash?
Well, I think it's a combination of that shadow of 2008 and some longer-run troubling trends in our economy. But yes, absolutely. For example, the 20% of adults aged 26 to 34 now live with their parents or other family members. The number of those even who live independently who are carrying student debt, like your comments suggested, is much higher than in the past. And this age group is even worse off than the younger age group, because studies show that if you enter the job market in the middle of a depression, it hurts your wages and your job prospects for many, many years, often for the rest of your life. But in addition, of course, there are the peculiar kinds of, and particularly American kinds of, increase in economic inequality, volatility. People no longer feel that they're going to have a guaranteed job, that they're going to have a pension, so they have to really worry about that sort of thing. And there's so few support systems for combining work and family. You know, as Janet pointed out, the child care has risen faster than inflation. The cost of tuition and fees in relation to the median salary has more than tripled over the last several decades. And you put that in with the increasing pressure to pay for enrichment programs for your children, and a lot of people are exactly in the position that your callers are talking about, just feeling like, I can't afford more than one child, or two at the most, or maybe I can't even afford another one. The hidden costs of moving to neighborhoods that have good schools, tremendously important for people, and high costs of housing tends to really depress marriage rates and probably child-raising rates as well.
Boston's with us now. Ken, thanks for your call. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. So my wife and I actually just had a son. He's 6 months old now.
Congratulations.
And the only way we thank you very much. The only way we can afford it is because I'm a software engineer who graduated without any student debt, and her family was hit pretty hard by the recession, so she had to take on a lot of student debt. And so the only way we can make the numbers work is because I didn't have any debt at all. And a lot of my peers were carrying the debt, like a lot of our friends. Babies aren't even like on the horizon, at least for another 4 years maybe. And I think my bigger concern about this, now that I think about it a little bit more, is that like as my son grows up, what's going to happen with like the income disparity amongst like the families and the people he interacts with? Are they all going to be upper middle class like my wife and I and our family? And what's going to happen with like the middle class kind of families that he might otherwise know?
Now, these are all really important questions, and ones that, from the perspective of today, are difficult to predict with any specificity, because we don't know whether the baby drought will continue on for a long time. But certainly he'll be part of a small birth cohort, and that will affect the way he grows up in America, just the same way being part of an enormous birth cohort affected me.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, I'm not losing sleep over it, but it kind of is a little concerning from that, like an income disparity and kind of wealth gap type thing, if only poor people and rich people are having babies.
Go ahead, Stephanie. I heard you trying to get in there.
Oh, well, sorry. I just thought that it was very thoughtful of your caller to talk about the increase in economic inequality and insecurity and what that meant, both in terms of, your child's exposure to other people and in terms of understanding these very difficult dynamics. Because, you know, the recovery has not really ameliorated this 40-year rise in economic inequality and insecurity. I saw a study of the job and business gains between 2011 and 2015. The bottom 60% of zip codes in America got only 1 in 4 of the new jobs created in those years, and the bottom 20% actually lost jobs during the period. So, yes, this inequality is also going to be with us.
A 2016 report from the Pew Research Center found that the U.S. Latino population was in decline, in part due to decreasing birth rates. In a local news report out of Utah that year, Juan Ruiz, president of the state's Latin American Chamber of Commerce, attributed the change to American cultural influences.
The fact that more and more Latinos are in contact with those types of families, the ideology of just having just a small family, a few kids, is becoming more of a predominant factor.
Joining me now from Philadelphia is Emilio Parado. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania who studies the U.S. Hispanic population, demographics, and international migration. Emilio, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Okay. Is that Chamber of Commerce official right? Hasn't the birth rate already declined in the countries that are sending people to the United States?
That's correct. And I'm going to elaborate a little bit on somewhat of a different explanation about what's going on. We very quickly jumped to behavioral changes to explain changes in fertility rate and fertility in general within the people are doing things differently. And obviously the recession has affected the decision to have a child and so forth. But when you look at measures such as rates, you are looking at really two variables. One is the numerator, which is the number of births, and the denominator, which is the number of women. And things are happening to the denominator that it's also affecting our fertility rates. The point that I'm trying to get at is that when you begin to disaggregate this decline in fertility in the U.S., the most striking feature is that it's actually really declining among immigrants and not among the native-born population. Among the native-born, the number of births has declined like around 8% which is what you would expect due to the recession. But when it comes to immigrants, it has actually declined twice as much. It has declined like 16% between 2007 and 2015, the number of births. We tend to jump to behavioral explanations when we see that change, and we say, you know, this is because immigrants are facing the recession differently, and so they're having postponing childbearing, and they're not having kids, or adopting cultural patterns from the U.S. But the reality is that what has changed is the dynamics of immigration. Since 2007, we have seen a dramatic change in immigration patterns. Immigrants are no longer coming primarily from Latin America. They are coming primarily from either Europe, Canada, Africa, and especially Asia. And there's a connection between immigration and fertility. When people move to the U.S., there's a tendency to have a child. So even if you disaggregate the fertility by origin of immigrants, the number of births to immigrant Hispanic women declined 30%, whereas for African immigrants, the number of births has actually increased 16%. What's been happening that we have not been integrating very well in our explanations of fertility are the changes in immigration and migration flows. Immigrants contribute to the U.S. population but when they come to the U.S., but they also contribute when they have children in the U.S. Since they're no longer coming from Latin America, their contribution to the fertility has been declining. The countries that are actually sending immigrants to the U.S., they are going back to contributing to fertility.
Emilio Parado joins us from Philadelphia. Stephanie Kuntz is in Olympia, Washington. You're listening to On Point, and we'll go next to Sarasota, Florida. Carrie is with us now. Carrie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi, I was just calling. My husband and I are both 34 years old. We currently have one child, and I'm pregnant with our second child right now. And we are really a little concerned. We are trying to, he just finished college, so he is now in the workforce. I also currently work. And like I said, we're pregnant with our second child, and we're really struggling to, you know, all of these bills and, you know, trying to find childcare. But we made a decision that we wanted to have a family, and so we're just trying to make it work with a little bit of help from our family. But it's been really hard.
Carrie, do you think you will be returning to employment sooner than you would have otherwise if money was not such a pressing thing?
Yes, absolutely. I am going to have to return to work and probably only take 5 to 6 weeks off. That's probably all we'll be able to afford.
Was that part of the strategizing, part of the conversation inside the household before you even got pregnant a second time?
Yes, I'm a teacher. So we even were trying to figure out, could I get pregnant and have this baby over the summer where I wouldn't be losing as much work? Unfortunately, that didn't work out for us this time. I'm going to be delivering it at the end of October, but that's okay. We're just going to do the best we can.
Go ahead, Emilio.
If I could say something, I think that this was mentioned before, and I would like to add something about the calculation to have children. And I think it's good to remember that families and children have always been expensive, and it's always an investment. I think that one of the issues that the recession has highlighted, I think it's one of the issues that differentiates countries to have higher or lower fertility, is actually the degree of uncertainty. Uncertainty about whether you're going to have a stable job, uncertainty about whether you will be able to afford a house, and the recession has actually made things very uncertain, and everybody's at risk of losing their job. They're not the cost of health insurance keep rising, and health coverage keeps rising, and that degree of uncertainty is a main factor, which is, it's not just the cost of children, it's that uncertainty about being able to afford them.
Stephanie?
Well, I think that's true. That's but I also think it's very important to look at the different educational and economic and cultural factors in different countries. And as you know, when women first started, when women first started being pulled into the labor force at very low wages, insecure jobs, it was pretty easy to get them out of the labor force. It was pretty easy to convince them to go out of the labor force, whether you wanted to convince them or not, by just keeping it very hard to combine work and family. But one of the things that's really changed as women have had more access to jobs that not only bring in important income, but that that have meaning to them and that are rewarding, is that it used to be that if it was hard to combine work and family, most women didn't work. But it's increasingly true that if it's hard to combine work and family, many women do not have a family.
We're discussing the historically low birth rate in the United States. You can join the conversation. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day, and there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about the historically low American birth rate and what it could mean for future U.S. demographics. You can join the conversation. Does the birth rate decline signal trouble ahead? Or do you see bright spots in the numbers? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio. My guests are Emilio Parado, a sociology professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and Stephanie Kuntz, a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College. And Katie is with us now from Akron, Ohio. Katie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I have a beautiful 16-month-old daughter, and I'm actually still working on paying off the hospital bills from her birth. And I've made the decision, because now I'm starting to think about paying for preschool, that I will not have any more children as a political statement. I'm going to write to my congressman and tell him, I'm not doing this until you give me a world worth bringing children into.
What about your own family, Katie? Did your own parents have to make calculations like this, or is it the modern setup that's really confounding couples your age?
Well, my own family, you know, my parents made decisions about what was important. They had four children, and they wanted to send us all to private school, so we never went on big vacations. And so that's one thing that they did, but I'm very fortunate for how...
Well, yeah, but four is a lot different from one.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the main reason I'm able to easily afford my daughter is because I didn't marry a millennial. My husband's 12 years older than me. So we, you know, we have a house, we have two cars, we have stable jobs, and, you know.
But it sounds like you would have had more children.
Yeah.
If money was not such a pressing concern.
Correct. But I feel like, you know, Washington is trying to tell women that our uteruses are powerful and they need to be controlled. And, you know, I think that by choosing to actively not have children, millennials can take some power back. We don't have the lobbying dollars to do it that way, but we could use, especially millennial women, can use our bodies and say, we're not giving you more children for this country until you give us a country worth having children in.
And let me just remind people, we're talking about 500,000 fewer children being born every year in the United States than the old numbers would have predicted, using birth rates from earlier times in our history. Katie, good luck with the kid, and thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Stephanie Kuntz?
Well, I think that she has making several political statements there, but the ones that I see most most supported by the research, is that if our country's complete failure to really provide adequate and affordable support systems for people who want to combine, as most women either need to do or want to do, work and family, many studies find that there's a strong positive effect of daycare availability and affordability on the transition to motherhood. Another thing that we find that's quite interesting is that work-family policies that make it more possible for men to get involved are also really helpful to families in making these decisions. In Europe and the Nordic countries, it is men who have taken paternity leave and who have gotten involved. The women are much more likely to have a second or third birth once they've seen the involvement of the father, and the fathers are happier too once they've had the opportunity to do that. So that's one positive thing, direction we could move in without in any way trying to prevent people from getting access to the other problem is that you've got an administration that's actually making it very difficult for women to have contraception or reproductive rights. That's the wrong way to increase our birth rate. There are much more constructive ways to do so.
Emilio Parrado, you heard our caller, Katie, with a very specific and political take on fertility as an issue.
Yeah.
As you play out the numbers, does this erode the actuarial assumptions that, for instance, the Social Security Administration is making about what America is going to look like in the 2040s and the 2050s?
Partially. The reality is that we can anticipate some of these changes in behavior. But I want to go back to the issue of immigration. You mentioned 500,000 less births from what is expected. 200 of those, 200 less, is among immigrant Hispanics. So that the real change that we have not been taking into account is immigration. The political context, as the previous caller was mentioning, the lack of easy access to healthcare, the difficulties in planning fertility, uncertainty about job stability that compromises family life. All of those political and social changes are contributing to low fertility. And if you believe, as a demographer, that the changing age composition of the U.S. population, the fact that we're becoming older and older, is a problem because somebody is going to have to support the aging population, somebody is going to have to take the new jobs that we want to create, etc. It poses this tension. What do we do? And immigration has been a source of rejuvenation of the U.S. population, both because immigrants come to the U.S. and they're younger, but also because they have kids. So when we think about the U.S. population broadly, not just separating fertility and immigration, the reality is that the two processes are connected. So closing the border, closing the doors to immigrants is going to have a much bigger effect on our population than what we anticipate in our projections, in our assessment of the solvency of the Social Security Administration. And that discussion is not taking place when we're talking about immigration. And the two dimensions of the population are very closely connected, and we should integrate them.
Well, just to clarify, and someone listening to the program pointed out that we're using fertility and birth rate and not defining either term. Birth rate is a measurement of the entire population, while fertility rate is a measurement of a group of individuals in the population. So birth rate is expressed in relationship to a time interval, while fertility rate is expressed in relation to the number of females in the reproductive age.
Let me clarify some very simple things about fertility, because that's sometimes people take for granted, and it's not clear. When people think about fertility, and I say the word fertility, people are really thinking about family size. They're thinking about total number of children. So people think about having 2, 3 family size. And you only know that when people are done with their reproductive periods, and that's why you see women having children at age 40, and so they may still end up with 2 or 3 or 1, and when they get to 45. Fertility rates captures what they're doing at one point in time. People might not have kids at one point in time. That depresses the rate because they're not having kids at that point in time, but they might still end up with 2 or 3 children. So the discussion about rates is a discussion of the fluctuation in terms of what people are doing in terms of having kids. It has a huge impact on the population. But for the people involved, they might catch up later, or they might still have 2 kids. So the 2 things get confused, and sometimes people think that because rates are lower, people are going to end up with smaller families, which might be the case, but no, it's not always the case.
Petersburg, Illinois is our next stop. Ted, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. I'm calling just to make a simple point that if we're worried about not having enough children to pay into Social Security to support the baby boomers, it sure seems pretty stupid to be throwing 800,000 of them out of the country after we've paid to educate and train them.
And we will also not have the downstream of the children of those young people paying into all these systems as well. So Ted, you're suggesting that this is part and parcel of the immigration debate, not something divorced from it.
It's right in there.
Yeah, let me...
Thanks a lot for your call.
Yeah. I think that, you know, this does connect with the immigration debate, and unfortunately for a demographer, the immigration debate has been framed in terms of national security, cultural change, racial and ethnic composition, but it would be good for demographers to start connecting these dots a little bit more precisely, so that in the public discussion about immigration, we do think in terms of the U.S. population, not just in these other dimensions.
Stephanie Kuntz?
I think a couple of things occur to me. One is that there are ways that you could probably increase the fertility rates here in terms of the fact that make it easier for people to envision having children, making it easier for them to do so. But I also think this question of who will support the aging population, yes, we need young people, and I agree with the comments that have come in about not only needing to the immigration aspect of this as well, but then another question is, will there be enough traditional jobs for those young people, given what we've done with outsourcing, with subcontracting, with the increasing use of artificial intelligence and robots? And it's not just for demographic reasons, but also because of a whole lot of economic changes that I think we're going to have to rethink the way we organize work and find ways to support people as they age. So it's the tip of the iceberg of a big challenge for us.
Nashville, Tennessee is next. Megan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. I'm 39 and I have a 6-year-old, and I can relate to all the juggling and the financial struggles other people have mentioned. But what I wanted to say from my observation is that I think there's, from the previous generations, there's been this sort of social expectation and tradition that what you do is you go to college, you get married, you have a baby. And I think what the millennials are doing in more ways than one is questioning what they're sort of supposed to do. They're not necessarily going to just directly work for a big company. They're being entrepreneurs, they're roaming, they're discovering things. And I think that possibly children, you know, they're just trying to determine, is that actually right for them? Not just what they're supposed to do.
Ah, so Megan, you know, should we dispense with the hand wringing and just say, look, this is a different generation with different needs, different ideas about the world. They'll get to some of these life milestones, but they'll get to them on their own time. Stop worrying so much.
Yeah, because, I mean, I understand the Social Security thing, and I agree with the immigration things you guys have been saying, but I think that, you know, this is creating more a positive thing in a different way for our society as far as them being more, you know, innovative and having the time that and, you know, to explore, you know, creating new businesses and new technology and stuff like that. Because, you know, when you have children, it is very limiting. I mean, you know, it becomes all about them. So I think it's more positive for our society in the way that they are taking the time to focus on other things that could benefit us as a society.
Megan, thanks a lot for your call. Stephanie Kuntz, we're getting toward the end of the hour, but it is an interesting thing to say, well, look, people are going to live a lot longer. And, you know, they're going to get married later. They're going to buy their first house later if they buy one at all. They're just ordering their lives in a different way. But there's also a biological aspect to this that now has seen people who are getting married much later than they had expected, freezing eggs, and people who are still trying to get traction in their careers, planning on having children at an age where they might have even been anticipating the opening chapters of menopause. Is there a biological limit to these social changes that we're making?
Well, yes, there is. And to the extent that they are made voluntarily, I don't think that we should force people or get really agitated about choices that they make. But as I said earlier, the gap between how many kids people say they want and how many we expect them to have has reached its widest point in 40 years. And that means a lot of millennials, and certainly a lot of my former students who are just at that age, really do want to have children but are looking at the uncertainty, the lack of a living wage, the lack of family-friendly work policies, not just maternity leave, but also paternity leave, because a lot of these young millennials really want to have men involved, too. And so they're delaying more than they want to. And that, I don't think, is a positive thing. I think that we as a society should be making it easier, not harder, for people to combine in the ways that they think are appropriate, work and family life.
Emilio Parrado, we only have about a half a minute left, but is this a straight line trend, or could we bounce up and see higher birth rates in coming years?
I don't think so. And I mean, there might be some fluctuation, but I want to, pick up on what the previous caller was saying. And people are changing their values and are changing their expectations, and they're changing what they see as their lives, and either for political reasons, environmental reasons, career reasons, and they do think about children, they would like to do it, but it's unclear to what extent it's a priority for them, and we should respect those changing cultural orientations too.
Emilio Parrado is a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He studies U.S. Hispanic population, demographics, and international migration. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College and the author of many books on the subject, including The Way We Really Are, Coming to Terms with America's Changing Families. Stephanie, good to talk to you again.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the way the American news business quotes mostly male experts. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.